Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Mike Graff is an occasional television weathercaster and former elementary school teacher and university professor. He has shared his writing and national park experiences with children and teachers in hundreds of schools. Mike has published more than 90 fiction and nonfiction books for children and teachers. His latest book is National Parks, Pop Up and Build. It reveals the beauty of America's unforgettable landscapes with a three-dimensional tour of its national parks. Each of the 59 U.S. national parks is profiled in this illustrated guide, and five of the nation's most prominent parks, Yellowstone, Yosemite, Grand Canyon, Everglades, and Badlands, are featured as large pop-up models that can be assembled using the pieces included in the book. Mike Graff, welcome.
Hi again, Nancy.
That introduction is quite lengthy, but you're quite accomplished when it comes to this type of book.
Well, you know, it started a long time ago working on books on national parks, and I'm very fortunate to continue to do that. Really, you know, there's an old saying, you know, national parks are America's best idea, and I happen to agree with that saying. We really have a unique national park system with an incredible amount of diversity of scenery and history and cultural heritage. So we're very lucky to be able to celebrate and explore those.
For people who may not be familiar with your previous books on national parks, how did you set that up? How did you tell the story? How did you blend fact and fiction?
Well, that series has 13 books in it, The Adventures with the Parkers. So the Parkers are a made-up family, and their thing is to go to national parks every summer and spend a couple of weeks there exploring and hiking and ranger talks. So I took on their persona, and I go to the parks and do all of that, and I bring a little tape recorder. And as I experience different things or hear different stories or learn about things that can happen or have happened in the parks, I record it and then fictionalize it as if it happens to the Parkers when they're in the parks. And then I throw in little sidebars to teach about geology or geysers or bears, whatever the aspects of that park leads to. So it's a fiction, nonfiction kind of guidebook combination, that series.
You know what I liked about this fictional family is that boys and girls have different things they focus on, slightly different interests. And for example, if they keep a journal, which you have your children do, the boy focuses on one thing, the girl focuses on another. They enjoy similar experiences, but they have a slightly different slant. So I was glad to see that you set it up so that you had a boy and a girl in this family. So there's a four-member family. And then there's not one that's older than the other. You have to be the same age. How did that occur to you?
Well, they're fraternal twins. It's kind of a backstory with that. Maybe about 20 years ago, I was recruited by a publisher out of the Bay Area, Foghorn Press. And at that time, they had a grant to do a California State Park series. And they found me and they found another author and brought us to San Francisco where they were located. And we all sat at a table and brainstormed, how would we want this state park series to go? And I came up with this idea of a family. Down the line, that particular publisher, things happened there and the grant dried out and I ended up having most of the ideas. So I took this story and said, or the idea for this and said, it really needs to go national. I mean, you can cover Yellowstone or Grand Canyon or versus California when you've got Anza Borrego or Big Basin, which are great state parks in California, but they don't have the amount of, you know, notoriety that a Yellowstone or Grand Canyon does. So I thought, I've got to get boy and girl in there. I want to focus on that 8 to 12-year-old age. I'm going to come up with these fraternal twins. Morgan and James are forever going into fifth grade.
So tell us the name of one of these books.
The newest one in that particular series is Secrets of the Sequoias. It takes place in Sequoia Kings Canyon National Park. There is a Yosemite one also, but the sequoias in Yosemite and Kings Canyon are unbelievable. The groves are easy to get to. They're massive. There's trails throughout them. So the emphasis of that book is the Parker family, including Morgan and James, explore the sequoias. But also at the end of the book, they climb Mount Whitney, the tallest peak in the United States. It's out of Alaska, and Mount Whitney's right on the Sequoia border. So I climbed Mount Whitney also for that. This is my second time up there. It's a great climb. The kids are 9 turning 10, which is about as young as I would recommend somebody doing that climb. But it's also very popular, and it's on a permit system now because it gets very, very crowded in the summer.
Well, you do aim it at that age group, but those of us who are adults, I mean, I find myself saying, wow, I didn't know that.
You know, that's the thing. There's so much to learn in a national park, and I was a fourth and fifth grade teacher, so that's the age I was focused on. But everybody enjoys the parks, all ages, and really, you know, the book is set up for families, especially families who love to go to national parks. And the idea is you can go to the park and bring this home as a souvenir and think that's what we did, or you can bring it as a guidebook and say, well, I want to do what Morgan and James and the Parker family did. Here's the trails they went on. Here's the talks they did. Here's how they got a junior ranger badge. Here's the facts they learned about with geysers or glaciers or grizzly bears. There's something for everybody in national parks.
My guest is Mike Graff, and he has written more than 90. Is that the recent count?
It's about 95 now.
95 books of fiction and nonfiction for children and teachers. And the name of this family is not a name you'd forget because you named them the Parkers. The Parkers are Parkers.
The Parkers go to the parks. Well, you know, the my best man in my wedding, his last name is Parker. So I said, we like the publisher and I like the ring to it, the Parkers go to the park. So I said, can we use your last name? Morgan and James, Morgan is a friend of mine and James is another family's, you know, son. So, and then Kristen, the wife, is James's mom in real life. So it's all based on people I know with their permission. However, the characters' personalities don't match those people at all. They're all unique. Not exactly like the friends and the family that I made their names up after.
So you are a writer and children's book writer primarily. But when you go into schools, you do that frequently. In fact, I have to arrange to talk to you when you're in Chico. What do you tell them when you go into the schools? What do you talk about?
I actually do like performance theater, like assemblies in front of the whole school. I have about 9 different presentations that I offer. And on my website, teachers or librarians or principals, whoever I'm coordinating with, can choose. My most popular one is realistic fiction in national parks. So I combine through storytelling, drama, and facts and science, what it's like to be a realistic fiction author and all the tips and techniques I use, and what's going on in national parks and all the stories and drama and excitement and learning. And that's about a 1-hour assembly. I've got 8 others also that I offer, including some on weather and some just a tour of the parks. Sometimes I tailor it to different ages or what the school wants or different audiences. And then I have workshops as well. Like if I do certain assemblies, I'll come back with a writing workshop or a weather workshop. Usually those are smaller group, more hands-on. We do some story and fiction writing under my guidance. It's the teacher in me.
Yes. You could take the teacher out of the classroom, that's true. Now, when you go, do you dress? Because when you're a weatherman, you're dressed in a suit and tie and you look like a professional weatherman. When you go into the schools, you say it's a presentation that I'm just imagining maybe you wear a backpack. What do you, when you go in to do a presentation?
Well, I don't wear a suit and tie. I get a little dramatic. So there's a scene in one of my presentations where I'm pretending, as it happens in the Grand Canyon book in the Parker series, I'm pretending I'm camped out at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. And that's kind of the culminating scene for that realistic fiction talk. And so I'm in my tent and I'm setting up my tent and I'm worried about scorpions because I encountered scorpions at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. And I go through this whole drama scene on it. So I have to act it out and be able to move around. And it ends up a little bit of a scare scene for the audience. It's a gasp and all that.
Oh, do you get gasp from your audience?
I most of the time I do.
Well, that's how you know they're paying attention.
That's right. That's right.
Well, your newest book, when I saw how the format was, I thought, oh, because nowadays, if a kid wants to know about a particular park, say a park in his area of the country, he can just get on Google and say, Google the Badlands and find out about that park. But this is not Googleable, what you have done. And it was interesting how this came about. How did this book come about?
Well, I was, you know, being a published author with certain subjects, any publisher or I can go on Google. So last summer, sometime June or July, I got emailed by Quarto Publications out of London, and they're international. And they said, we found you, and we know you're a national park author and a teacher, and you write for this age. we're going to come up with a pop-up and build guide. That was their idea or concept. So you're going to write about all the national parks, and then you're going to be our consultant as we do the designs and illustrations and the maps and the graphics and the pop-up sections to make sure we get everything accurately. So what this book is, the pop-up and build guide, is a summary of all of our national parks and where they are, and the summaries are generally brief. And then we highlight five of the parks, the ones you mentioned, Yellowstone, Yosemite, Grand Canyon, Badlands, and Everglades. And they get a longer introduction section, and then they get puzzle or dioramic pieces that the purchaser of the book can pop up and build, and it becomes a 3D element. And then when you fold it up, it collapses back into the book. So there was a lot of design work in that, and I was consulting them along the way after I wrote all the sections for each of the 59 parks.
My guest is Mike Graff, and he has published more or less 95 fiction and nonfiction books for children and teachers, but his latest book is slightly different in format. He usually has a family having experiences in the park, but this one is called Pop Up and Build National Parks. Now, that very title, Pop Up, we might have some idea of what that means, but Pop Up has taken a different meaning now with the internet. So what is this pop up and build? Can you describe that?
So there are five parks, and we kind of debated which five. I'll take the Grand Canyon, where there's a full page display of a background of the Grand Canyon. And then we have these pieces in there on a different section of the book that the purchaser could pop these out.
So they like you pull out like on the dotted line.
Right. You pull out the pieces that were already pre-formatted, and then you follow the instructions in the guidebook and you place them in different elements and you build a diorama or a pop-up section for the Grand Canyon. And once you've done all those pieces, that particular full two-page display of the Grand Canyon, when you open the book, will pop up and be three-dimensional. And then if we've done it correctly and the owner of the book has done it correctly, you close the book and it'll collapse back into the book. So it'll still be a closed book, and that is done for five parks in there. A little side note on that, I'm saying Yellowstone, Yosemite, Grand Canyon, Everglades, and Badlands. That may or may not be the best five parks to do. I really wanted the Badlands, but Badlands is not in the top five as far as notoriety or attendance. They're thrilled, the Badlands National Park, that they're in there. But I know a lot of people in different parks, and a lot of them, or several of them, I should say, have emailed or we've had discussions like, why didn't you make Mount Rainier one of the parks?
Yeah.
Why didn't you make Zion one of the parks? And we thought Badlands regionally in the middle of the country was a nice change of pace, and also it's very unique, its scenery.
Well, it's all very colorful, and the fact that they don't have to use a pair of scissors to cut these pieces out, and you call it pop-up and build as opposed to, say, pop-up and put together.
Well, there's a lot of pop-up books out there that are already preset. So you can take them, and they're already done. This one you actually build yourself. And there's about 10, as you see right there, for Everglades. There's about 10 to 20 pieces for each of the parks that are preset. You pop out, follow the instructions, put them in their little spots and slots, and then you've got it.
After a break, I'll be back with my guest, Mike Graff, author of Pop Up and Build, Guide to the National Parks. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Part-time weatherman Mike Graff writes books about national parks. His latest is Pop Up and Build, Guide to the National Parks. You know, I was thinking that this would be, I'd say, a project for parent and child, even a younger child than your age group you normally direct your books to could do this and I think have fun with it.
Absolutely. With parent guidance, I think 5 and 6 year olds can do it. I had my wife and daughter build some of the sections at home while I watched just to see. I was wondering, but they're very adept at these things, more so than I am. So I wanted to see how it turned out.
Well, I've seen little kids, I think, before they could even talk, using an iPad and touching it and working. So kids are accustomed to these electronics from a young age. And I'll bet parents say, wow, this is great. I can get my kid off his iPad for a few minutes and look at this book. So that's in the very front of the book are these pieces that they detach and reattach. And then you have a section on parks and you have a map to show the relationship of these various parks. And you have a quote from President Franklin Roosevelt. And what do you have him say?
Sorry, I don't have my glasses. There is nothing as American as our national parks. The fundamental idea behind the parks is that the country belongs to the people, that it is in process of making for the enrichment of the lives of all of us. Sorry, I stumbled a little bit without my glasses. Now, I remember that was in there. One of the things I want to mention about, that's Franklin Roosevelt, but the Roosevelt family was very big in preservation, and Theodore or Teddy Roosevelt, I consider him one of the fathers of our national parks. You know, he had the whole idea of we can't duplicate him, we can't replace him, we can't make him better. The best thing to do is preserve them.
Well, and that's who the Roosevelt I usually think of when I think of parks is Teddy Roosevelt. And so it was nice to that you included this quote by Franklin Roosevelt. And you say in your introduction to the book, and I assume you wrote this.
Yeah, I wrote everything in there, yeah, except for the quotes, which are attributed to those who said them.
Right.
Yes. And the publisher and I, you know, we discussed certain things we wanted to include, too.
But it sounds like they gave you a lot of leeway and took your advice and your suggestions throughout.
In most cases, they did. You know, being from London, they needed someone in the United States to consult with them, someone who knew the parks well. There were a couple drawings or illustrations that we needed to change. There's a couple that I asked them to change that they didn't change. In the arches illustration in there, they have a wonderful picture of an arch over the red rock scenery of Utah, and it follows one of the arches in the park. They put a coyote on top of the arch, which in some cases is probably realistic for arches, but I thought it was a little bit more dramatic than necessary. I said, you know, I'm not sure if coyotes are going to climb up there or not, but they wanted to leave it up there. So things like that we debated back and forth.
Okay, you say in your introduction, the United States is amazingly ecologically diverse. The whole country has an incredible variety of landscapes, ranging from mighty redwood forests on the west coast to glaciated mountains and rainforests in the northwest. There are canyons among arid deserts, moist temperate forest, great grassy plains, and in some areas close to the freezing Arctic. The varied landscapes hold some of the most endangered species on the planet, and the national parks provide a haven for these creatures and plants to thrive, undisturbed by human impact. So I think you're encouraging an awareness of ecology and preservation in these young people who think, my gosh, I didn't know that this particular animal was in danger.
You know, reading or hearing you read that, I mean, really— And I'm a national park fan globally also, and I've been to many national parks in different countries. And we're the ones, America, who came up with this national park system, and other countries have you know, duplicated it in their own way. And I've been to many national parks in, let's say, Australia, New Zealand, for example, and they have amazing places there. But the diversity of North America and what we have as far as our climates and our topography that we've preserved in national parks, it's almost— I don't think it can be duplicated across the world. And I know there's many, many great places across the world and great preserved places. But for example, the Great Smoky Mountains in North Carolina and Tennessee, one of our World Heritage National Parks, they do bioblitzes out there, which means rangers and volunteers will study tracts of land for living creatures and document those tracts of land. That's a bioblitz. They'll go out for 24 hours at a time and count the species, you know, whether it's plants, insects, or animals. And my understanding of the bioblitz is, and many other parks do them too, but the Smokies may be one of the most biodiverse places on the planet. And they find when they do these bioblitzes living things they didn't even know existed before. So, yeah, the endangered species is part of it, but also preservation of the unknown or preservation of the cultures of the past, such as Mesa Verde National Park, which has the Native American ruins, or the history of the past, you know. But the diversity is just unbelievable in the United States.
Well, you take different sections of the United States. For example, the Northeast and Midwest, the Northeast in particular, is so far away from where we are in California that we may not have ever heard of Acadia Park.
And what a great place it is. Well, now, my family's going back there this year. The last time I went was 8 years ago with my wife and daughter, and that was to write the book. And we have wanted to go back ever since. It's a long way from here,
yes,
about as far as we can go in our country. The nearest airports would be like Providence, Rhode Island, or Boston's not too far away. Acadia is interesting because there's a lot of private land there. So there are townships and homes and cottages kind of mixed up within the national park boundaries. There's preserved areas and private areas. So it's kind of a patchwork national park, and there's islands preserved. But what an incredible place. One of the unique things about Acadia is the ocean life and the tide pools that are going on there. So the sea life and the islands around the park are protected. But another unique thing they did is that they don't have the mountains that we do in California out in the West. Their mountains are 1,000 to 1,500 feet high tops, and there's a trail system there is incredible. And you'll have, you know, gentle climbs up these mountains, but there's cliffs there as well. So when the CCC, or the Civilian Conservation Corps, was helping to establish the park and the trails there, they built some iron rungs and ladders and you know, kind of precipice climbs up these cliffs. So you can take the easy way, or you can take the hard way up the climbs and meet at the exact same spot. So hiking there is a really unique experience.
And, well, I might remind people we're talking about Acadia, and this is a national park that's in the Northeast.
I want to mention the two trails that are most famous for climbing ladders and iron rungs, the Precipice Trail, which is about almost a mile of that, and the Beehive Trail, which they say is a beehive because it goes in a circle, the actual trail. And if you're at the ground, you can see people circling as if they're bees up those iron rungs.
Well, when it gets so hot here in the Central Valley of California in the summertime, that might be a good destination to take the kids or just your adult friends, family, to Acadia Park.
Right up the road to Lassen also.
Yeah.
At 7,000 feet and a lot cooler, and they keep the snow in some areas into the summer.
Well, when you say you travel to these parks, and you must have been to a lot of parks.
Started when I was about 9 or 10 years old. My family's summer vacation was always, you know, a week or two going to national parks, Yellowstone, Zion, Grand Canyon, and then a week in Tahoe. We always ended it in Tahoe, which ironically, there was consideration of making the whole Tahoe Basin a national park in the 1920s. And then private, you know, holdings and other things took over. And so now it's all the way it is now. But yeah, I I've been to many parks, and some of the parks I go to again and again and again and again, just love them.
Well, if they are nearby, say if they're in California, then that's a little easier to do. So maybe it's you go to some often because they're your favorites, but also because they're a little easier, they're more accessible.
Yeah, I'll mention one. I'm going to be there in January, and the great time of year to go is around now through April. It's Pinnacles National Park, which became the 59th national park in the country about 5 years ago. There's a new national park, Indiana Dunes and Lakeshore right now. But Pinnacles is near Santa Cruz, Monterey. It's a very small park. It was a monument for a while, but it just upgraded status to a national park. In the springtime there, the wildflowers are unmatched. There's a series of caves there, and there's water and water falls through the caves, and it has an incredible trail system. So if you wanted to go from here, from Chico, it's about a 4.5-hour drive, and there's camping there. The nearest towns would be Soledad and Hollister, where there's hotels, but incredible hiking, especially February, March, April. By May, it tends to dry up. It's very crowded in the summer, so they have a shuttle system because the parking lots fill up on the summer week or the spring weekends, I should say. What a great park, and I can't wait to go in a couple weeks in January.
Well, there's such variety, and we've talked about that variety. For example, a Joshua tree is, and you say not far from bustling Los Angeles, a large desert wilderness. So do you have a preference as to mountain greenery or deserts? Or because my own preference is greenery, and deserts are beautiful, but I'd rather spend time with trees that are green as opposed to an arid area like
a
desert.
It goes back and forth. I mean, you know, we all think mostly of summertime travel to the national parks. Last summer, my wife and daughter and I's big trip was to Olympic National Park for a week in Washington and then Mount Rainier for a week. And that's greenery and glaciers and streams and waterfalls and chilly and cool and really, you know. But now we're thinking, well, we can't wait to go to Mesa Verde and Arches and Zion. Of course, if you go in June or July, you're going to go with 100-degree heat.
Yes.
So, you know, and then we're going to go to Acadia also. So we kind of go back and forth on that.
Well, this book has a unique setup, a unique format, and you have an illustration on the back cover of what it can possibly look like when the kids and the parents put this all together, build it, as you your word in the title, is Pop Up and Build National Parks, a unique adventure through America's great outdoors. And you mentioned you have five pop-up parks that the kids can put together, can build. But then you also have a really extensive descriptions of all these other parks. You mentioned Olympic Park, Mount Rainier, and Glacier. And Glacier is, you mentioned, is often called the crown jewel of the continent due to its spectacular beauty. And when I was there, it was too cold and foggy when I was there. So I don't feel I really got to see Glacier Park. So I'm sure you've been there.
When were you there? What time of year?
Oh, gosh, I don't remember. It was kind of odd because when I got there, like we were in shorts, it was warm weather. 4 days later, we had on our overcoats and there was snow on the ground.
Yeah.
So I don't remember the time of year because of that.
It has a short season there. So it's in northern Montana. It backs up right to the Canadian border. And on the other side is Waterton Lakes National Park in Canada. So that's an international peace park, those two combined. And you can actually take a boat across from one border to the other, you know, going through customs. So it's not as high elevation as some of California's mountains, generally ranging from about 3,000 to 9,000. But because it's so far north in latitude, its window for snow-free trails is usually July and August. And even then, some of the higher elevations there will have snow on the trail. But it's known for the glaciers. So one side note about it, it's a little sad. In the 1800s, when Europeans were first discovering it, there were 150 known active glaciers in the park. And now there's 20. And they're melting quick. The rangers are saying by 2030 to 2035, there'll be none left. So that's a very short period of time. They'll still call it glacier because the scenery was carved by the glaciers. I do want to mention, I was talking to my wife about this the other day. The first time I went to Glacier, I was on a bike tour. And I rode my bike with a group of other people up going to the Sun Road, which is the main highway that crosses the park. And back then in the 1980s, it wasn't discovered yet. I mean, there were people there, but nowadays it's very crowded in the summer. So you have to book early and, you know, reservations for campgrounds or hotels. And my understanding is if you go and you want to go from one part of the park to another, make your drives early because some of the parking lots for the very popular areas of the park do tend to fill up. And so you might not be able to get to where you're going in some cases unless you plan it out well ahead of time. And one of those popular areas is an area in the middle of the park called Many Glacier. It would be their version of Yosemite Valley. There's a phenomenal lodge there. There's a campground there. And there's trail access there to several glaciers. And you can see some of those glaciers from that area there. And it's just one of my favorite places in the world.
My guest is Mike Graff, and his latest book, one of his 95 fiction and nonfiction books for children and teachers, is Pop Up and Build, National Parks, a unique adventure through America's great outdoors. And I hesitate to ask about your favorites, but if there might be one that you think is overlooked, you mentioned, for example, Acadia for a Californian, but is there one that you think gets overlooked and when people should pay attention to?
Yeah, you know, I mean, what we do when, like, when I do the Parkers series is we look at attendance records and we pick the most attended. You know, and you can go online and type in least crowded or most overlooked national parks. I'll mention one, Big Bend National Park in Texas. It's a hard place to get to. It's right at the Texas-Mexico border. It's got an incredible variety of ecosystems and plant and animal diversity. But because it's so far away and in nearest airports and long drives, and Texas is a big state, that one gets overlooked quite a bit. A couple others that I think are incredibly unique is Isle Royale and Voyager up in the Great Lakes region, or in one case, Isle Royale, right in the middle of Lake Superior. So you have to fly out there, rent a car, boat into the park. So the visitation is small.
I think that can be an advantage if you don't like
absolutely crowds.
Absolutely.
You want the isolation. But, you know, Acadia, Glacier, Grand Tetons, those are some of my favorites, but they're not seldom visited at this point. They're very, very well known. But not far from here, Lassen. I mean, we in Chico think of Lassen, and they've got, I think, 8 to 10 campgrounds up there in Drake's Bad Ranch. But it's such an easy getaway from here in Chico, and you just don't have the crowds on the trails that we would have in some of these other parks. But I also think, you know, in California, everyone wants to go to Yosemite, and for good reason. But Sequoia Kings Canyon spreads out the people more, has just equally, if not better, trails in some cases that access the sequoias. Last summer, I was doing a book signing in Sequoia. It was crowded in certain parts of the park, but I hiked to an unknown sequoia grove out of my campground, the Muir Grove. It was about 2 miles, had a bear right on the trail, and I got to a sequoia grove of about 30 giant trees. Nobody was there, and I was just like, in awe, like, I can't believe I'm here in this amazing place. I had never been on that trail before. So we can find these secret stashes even in some of the most crowded parks.
Well, with as many books as you've written, I'm sure that you're working on another one as we speak.
Fingers crossed.
What do we have to look forward to?
One of the books I wrote recently was A Scientist's Guide to the National Parks, and that one takes place in Sequoia Kings Canyon. It's all nonfiction, and what the scientists are doing in those parks to help preserve the parks and make it, you know, last for generations and study what the air pollution is doing and what's going on with sequoias and all that. So that particular publisher is an educational publisher, and there are 6 books in that series already. I did the Sequoia Kings Canyon one, but I've sent to them a list of other parks where there's great scientific work going on in the parks at this time that are not part of that series of 6. And I'm crossing my fingers that they're going to send me out there and say, here's a couple more we want. Great Smokies is one of them because of that biodiversity and the bioblitzing going on there. Acadia is another one. Mammoth Caves is one. You know, what's going on in the caves and some of the creatures of the caves, the albino crayfish and other creatures that only live inside a cave. So there's scientific work going on throughout the parks. They've only covered 6 so far. I'm hoping some more we agree on or get a contract on that soon.
So due to your reputation that you've built up, you don't really have to go looking for ideas. People come to you and say, hey, Mike, here's an idea.
It kind of is both ways. I mean, I've got a series of things that I'm pitching. I was actually talking to somebody, corresponding with someone yesterday. I was a camp counselor in summers at Kennelin Camps, which is in the Santa Cruz Mountains. They come up to Chico and recruit college students to be counselors. So the directors and I are still in touch. And potentially I may be going to Kennelin this summer, getting my daughter there and doing some research because I've always wanted to write a summer camp adventure series. And Kennelin would be the place to do the research. So I'm going to pitch that idea if I get to go to Kennelin. So I still work on ideas once in a while or every so often. A publisher will come to me and say, here's something we think you can help us with. And so it goes both ways.
Well, thank you, Mike. We'll look forward to your next adventure. And meanwhile, I'll remind people this newest book that's available, Pop Up and Build National Parks, A Unique Adventure Through America's Great Outdoors. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Nancy.
My guest was Mike Graff, author of Pop Up and Build, Guide to the National Parks. After a break, I'll ask Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep about 19th century explorer John C. Fremont and his wife, Jessie. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My next guest is host of NPR's Morning Edition, Steve Inskeep, who has written a book about how John C. Fremont and his wife Jessie helped cause the Civil War. The book that you wrote, Imperfect Union, How Jessie and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War, was such a fascinating book for me. I had a personal connection to a lot of what you had to say, but there was so much I had never known. So how did you get interested in this topic?
I'd read about them ever since I was a kid because I read books about the Old West and books about the Civil War, and they appear in those books again and again and again. But they're not often treated very deeply. They're minor characters described as very famous, very ambitious, even very vain, making a lot of mistakes along the way. And so you learn bits about them, but I didn't know them deeply until much more recently. In recent years, I've been writing about the westward expansion of the United States. I wrote this book called Jackson Land, about Andrew Jackson, the president, and a Cherokee leader, John Ross, and their battle for more than 20 years over expelling Cherokees from their land in the eastern United States and moving them west of the Mississippi. That was an early phase of America's westward expansion. And when that project was done, I wanted to explore what happened next, the capture of the West and the Pacific Coast. And John and Jesse Fremont, both of them, were central figures in that story. John was a Western explorer who went out and mapped the Oregon Trail and went to Mexican-controlled California and even helped take it over. As an explorer, he did not discover that much that was so new, but he did go back to Washington, where he was based, and write best-selling accounts of his adventures. And in a sense, that, along with the maps, was the point. His mission was to publicize the West, to entice people to move along the Oregon Trail and settle the Oregon country near the Pacific coast, because that was the way the United States would take that land over, was through settlement. That was the point, and he, with Jesse's help, was a brilliant publicist, it turned out. They collectively were good publicists, and while making the West more famous, they also made themselves very famous.
Well, now, you mentioned Jessie just now, and when I first encountered Jessie and John Fremont, I thought, oh, John had a brother named Jessie.
Ah.
And then I discover, no, this is a woman, his wife. How did she get the name Jessie?
It's fascinating. She was the daughter of a senator, Thomas Hart Benton, who had a daughter and then expected the next child to be a son and appeared to be all ready to name the son after his father, Jesse. Turned out to be a daughter instead, but he was a stubborn guy, so he changed the spelling slightly, J-E-S-S-I-E, and went with that name. So he effectively gave her a boy's name, or what sounded like a boy's name. And Jessie wrote in a memoir many years later, "My father gave me early the place a son would have had. In the absence of a son, he didn't have one until later, he took her along hunting with him. She was devoted to him, and she would carry the game bag in which there might be a dead bird that he had just shot. And she would trail along after him in Washington when he went to work at the Senate, and he would leave her at the Library of Congress for safekeeping. And she would even trail along with him to meet presidents, starting with President Andrew Jackson. She grew up, in a sense, as a boy would, doing things that boys were supposed to be doing. And she wanted to do more of that. She wanted to be involved in politics. She wanted to be involved in her father's work of encouraging the settlement of the West. She wasn't allowed to because she was the wrong gender for the time. But she ultimately found a way to be her father's assistant and also to work with her father through her husband, who assisted her father's work through his explorations.
Well, I want to repeat her father's name as a senator, Thomas Hart Benton, because that name was very familiar, but I didn't know that the Thomas Hart Benton that we all know as a painter was a descendant of Jesse Fremont's father.
That's absolutely correct. They had the same name, and the painter is probably a little more famous today. But in the 1840s and 50s, and a little bit before that, Thomas Hart Benton, the senator, was a giant figure. He was one of Missouri's first two senators when it became a state in 1821, and he spent 30 years in the United States Senate. He was among the founders of the Democratic Party. He was a political giant with an opinion on every topic. He had an ability to give speeches for hours and hours. He had taught himself multiple languages. He was very erudite. He was also in many ways an awful person who owned slaves, just to give one example, and who killed a man in a duel once. In many ways, an appalling individual, and yet also a very talented lawmaker and senator who passed on a lot of his knowledge to his daughter.
Well, we know a good bit about Jesse's father, but what do we know about John Fremont's father?
Very little, except that he was a French immigrant. John Charles Fremont's father, who had a slightly different spelling to his name, by the way, fell in love with a Virginia aristocrat, and even though she was unable to get a divorce, they ran away together to Savannah, Georgia, where John was born. They then moved around the South, and the father died when John was very young, about 5 years old. And from that time on, the family was relatively poor. The mother had some of her inheritance she was able to claim, but they were a little short of money and living in Charleston, South Carolina. And so he began life as this penniless young man doing various things and trying to find his way in the world. He ultimately worked his way into the United States Army. He got a lieutenant's commission. He was part of something called the Army Corps of Topographical Engineers, which was supposed to map the West, among other places. And that was his early work, which was not work that would bring him great distinction necessarily, except for the fact that he met and eloped with this senator's daughter, who gave him access to the political connections and the media connections that were necessary to become a celebrity.
Well, you mentioned his born in Savannah and living in Charleston, and I was excited that he went to the College of Charleston because I spent a year teaching there.
Oh, okay.
And so I have a personal connection to a lot of these places. I lived in the mountains where the Cherokees lived, and It was called Enota, the Enchanted Valley. That's what it meant, yeah, in Cherokee. So a lot of this book was just touched me personally. But now, so that people, I mentioned that he went to the College of Charleston. He was not an ignoramus. He was a very smart guy, and I was impressed that he knew Greek, because when he saw the Golden Gate here in California, he thought of a Greek word.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. He's the guy who gave the name Golden Gate to the mouth of San Francisco Bay, and it was a play off of the Golden Horn, which was the name of a bit of a waterway, a trading port for the ancient city of Constantinople, now Istanbul, Constantinople and Istanbul, all the same city. That was the city where the ancient Romans conducted their trade with Asia, and that's why he called it the Golden Gate. I always thought that Golden Gate meant that San Francisco Bay was the golden entryway to California, but I was looking in the wrong direction. Fremont was looking outward. It was a golden portal outward to the Pacific and to Asia, and an opportunity for the United States to have its own direct trading routes with India and with China. He was playing off of the vision of Senator Benton, who had wanted this kind of a trading port in the Pacific for a long time. And he was looking forward in many ways to the world we have today, where the most important economic relationship, single relationship, probably is across the Pacific from America to China.
Well, you know, I'm amused that you said that, because that's precisely my own idea. I didn't realize it was that the Golden Gate was the entry into the harbor, and he was looking the other direction to Asia. It seems like that everything I read about him, John Fremont had impeccable timing. And typically he's known, I think, as the leading explorer of the 19th century. But all these other things, he was on the scene of so much that was going on in the United States, this new country.
Yeah, it's just amazing. And it's one of the reasons that he appears in surely thousands and thousands of history books, just never, or rarely, I should say, explored in great depth. There are only a relative few biographies about him over the last 150 or 160 years that have been written. But he's in thousands of books because he was involved in so much. He was involved in westward expansion. He was involved in the United States war with Mexico, which was part of that expansion. Involved in the Oregon Trail and the acquisition of Oregon by the United States. Involved in the creation of the Republican Party in the years before the Civil War. That gave him a role in causing the Civil War, bringing it about, because the Republican Party's creation was something that was seen as profoundly threatening to the South and is ultimately the reason the South left the Union and fired the first shot of the Civil War. He was then involved in the Civil War as a general, and he was fired by Abraham Lincoln, later challenged Lincoln for the presidency briefly in 1864, and even after the war, he was involved in transcontinental railroads. It was an epic, epic life that he lived, in large measure because he had Jesse Benton Fremont to fill in some of his shortcomings or inadequacies and to help him publicize himself and defend himself politically and do things that needed to be done. She was a huge part of the story, too.
Well, the very cover of the title of your book, the last few words, that Jesse and John Fremont helped cause the Civil War, that was intriguing to me.
Yeah, it is amazing. But it's just right there. It's in the creation of the Republican Party. There was this dramatic change going on in the United States at the time. It was a change in demographics. The North and South were divided over slavery. Northern states had gradually abolished slavery. Southern states ever more firmly embraced it. And any national political party tried to stay quiet on slavery for many, many years. They didn't want to offend anybody. They needed Southern votes in order to assemble an electoral majority, which meant they couldn't say anything against slavery even if they wanted to. Well, but then that changed. That changed because there was a change in population. The North grew in population much more rapidly, which gave them more power. And suddenly there was this party, the Republican Party in the North, that had a chance to win the presidency with Northern votes alone, which was very destabilizing.
Well, I was intrigued by that, too, because I hear a lot of reasons for the Civil War, but this shed new light on it. And I found that fascinating, Steve.
Well, I appreciate that, and I especially appreciate it because it relates to today, when we're also going through demographic changes that can be seen as profoundly destabilizing. And it's one of the underlying realities of our politics. When you ask about why our politics are so bitter, it's because you do have people who fear not just losing an election, but losing for all time. President Trump told his supporters in 2016, "This is your last chance to win," because of the demographic changes in the country, which he was going to stop. That's a thing that he explicitly said. Now we also have Democrats and more progressive people who fear being shut out of power forever because of the way the president is appointing conservative justices to lifetime appointments, and also treating the presidency in a certain way and seen as trampling many rules or seen as authoritarian. This is the underlying cause, I think, of a lot of the tension and the bitterness of our politics. People feel the stakes are very, very, very high.
Well, I want to thank you for writing this book, Steve. I found it so fascinating. I may not be your typical reader because of my own personal connections with this, but thank you for writing this book, Imperfect Union, How Jesse and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War.
Oh, I'm glad to have done it. Thanks for the invitation.
And now Richard Parker has some thoughts on the war between the states.
Robert E. Lee surrendered his sword at Appomattox on the 9th of April, 1869. This is believed to be a historical fact by many and a piece of typical Yankee-inspired fiction by others. These latter reside almost exclusively south of the Mason-Dixon line, of course, where I grew up and where my brother still lives. Not only did these Southern non-believers not believe that the Union Army won the war, many of them don't believe that the war is over. There's been a truce of sorts, sure, but there are Southern boys who are sure that the Articles of Surrender were a clever ploy by General Lee to distract the Union officer corps while he urged his soldiers to slink out of Virginia while the slinking was good. Now, of course, my brother, a moderately educated person, doesn't believe all that, but you wouldn't know it from watching him for a while. He's a charter member of the 33 and a third Arkansas Irregulars, and he's fully equipped for the role. He has a complete Confederate uniform, sewed up by our late sainted mother, and complete with a gray kepi-style cap he made himself. He fires a muzzle-loader rifle that fires a 50-caliber round ball with amazing accuracy. In fact, he was the state muzzleloader champion a couple of decades ago. He also built a small-scale Civil War-era cannon that fires a 1-inch lead ball nearly a mile. Now, Brother Michael is mainly in it for the amusement, I'm pretty sure, but he's serious about his amusement. While we're at it, let me be serious for just a minute. When I was in high school in Hot Springs, Arkansas, I played in the band. At football games, there was a tune we played at every game that made the fans nuts. It was called South. And the first part of it was a call and response that involved a cheer for the team. But then, after a drum cadence, we broke into a spirited version of Dixie, and the whole stadium stood up and went mildly crazy. It was still like that in that part of the world even well into the 60s. Memories of my younger years in the 1950s include images from the local JCPenney's store, where there were two water fountains side by side and two men's and two women's restrooms. You know the reason for this ridiculous duplication. It dates from the years of Reconstruction, during which time the North really did give the South something to be resentful about, and the hundred years of Jim Crow laws that followed that. Many of those laws were in effect until the 1960s, including the ones that justified all that extra plumbing at the Penny's store. Well, racial matters were not the only things at stake during the Civil War. There were and are Southerners today who claim that slavery was not really the issue. The issue was states' rights. But, and however, the main right the Southern states wanted to hold on to was the right to own slaves. So it goes around, and then it comes around. Racism these days is different. African Americans are discouraged from voting not because of their race so much, but because of the way they might vote. I'm not so sure that this is progress. Well, good grief, I was serious for more than a minute. That may be some kind of record, and it hardly hurt at all. I'll try it again soon. Meantime, this is Richard Parker.
Thank you, Richard. I'd also like to thank my first guest, Mike Graff, whose new book is Pop Up and Build, Guide to the National Parks, and also Steve Inskeep, host of Morning Edition, who has a new book, Imperfect Union, How Jesse and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.